Okay then, we listen to the, you've got it ready, have you, Mai? Yeah, so it's a bit of Nagarjuna, and then a bit of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, and then a bit of the mantra, say the usual refuge prayer and mandala, and we can say, oh yeah, the verses from the ornament for clear realization, just a few of those. So that's it, yeah. Okay. A bit louder than yesterday, maybe? Just a touch? Wasn't quite loud enough for me, but almost.
Thank you.
So the mantra of the perfection of wisdom. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. Tayata om gati gati para gati para samgati bodhi soha. So just to recite a few verses from the Ornament for Clear Realizations itself. Verses from the Ornament for Clear Realizations. Just to make one point as we're going along. In the beginning, the first line, it says, the knower of all. So that's best to refer to as the knower of bases, yeah? That's the one for the hearers, the middling scope type of being. So don't confuse that with the knower of all aspects, which is the knower in the mind of the Buddha, which comes, you know,
bit further down the verse.
So I was confused for a while, nor of all aspects, different things. So nor of all is nor of basis. Who as the nor of all is she who leads the hearer seeking peace to utter peace, who as the nor of paths makes those who work the good of beings achieve the world's welfare, and well endowed with whom the sages teach on this all aspect had variety, I bow down to the mother of the Buddha, and here a bodhisattva companies the pathway of the nor of aspects all. The teacher has expounded here the wits by others not experienced, so that it's seen by those with sense. Once they have set in mind the sutra's theme, in essence the ten dharma deeds, the easy realization of them is the purpose why this is composed. Perfection of wisdom is thoroughly expounded in eight categories. The nor of all aspects itself, the nor of past, the nor of all, full realization of all aspects and gone to the peak and serially an instantaneous full enlightenment and dharma body these the eight. Mind generation guidance the four limbs of definite discrimination, foundation of achieving's that which has the nature of the Dharma element, observed intent and then activities of armor and engaging and collections final issue once these are the sages nor of aspects all. With aspects, trainings, qualities, and faults, marks part concorded liberty, discrimination to and company of irreversible trainees, the sameness of mundane existence, peace, and unsurpassably pure lands, along with skillful means as well, this is for realizing of aspects all. With nature and complete enjoyment both, so to the other emanation, the Dharma body with activities, it in four aspects is proclaimed. My generation is for others' sake, the wish for full enlightenment, as it is in the sutras this and that, are set out briefly and at length. Moreover, earth and gold and moon and fire, a treasury jewel minus sea, a Vajra mountain medicine close friend, wish granting gem a son a song, a monarch treasury and thoroughfare, a vehicle and a fountain and a pleasant sound, a river and a cloud, with these its types are 22. So refuge, bodhicitta, and then the mandala.
Sangye chidan sogi chognam la janchu badu dani kapsu chi dage che shege personam ki drola panja sangye drupa shok. Sangye chidan sogi chognam la janchu badu dani kapsu chi dage che shege personam ki drola panja sangye drupa shok. Sangye chidan sogi chognam la janchu badu dani kapsu chi dage che shege personam ki drola panja sangye drupa shok.
Short mandala.
Oh, Sajipaki, Jukshin Metal.
So let's just take a few moments in silence now to think over the meaning, especially of the refuge prayer and bodhicitta, coupling it with our deeper sort of longing for understanding, entering into final wisdom, perfection of wisdom. Thank you very much. So, yesterday we had revived our application to understanding the perfection of wisdom by the Ornament for Clear Realizations. You know, we tried to touch on one or two subjects at least, best we could do. Remember that the ornament is opening up or making clear the hidden teaching of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So, the explicit teaching of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, as you see when we read them fairly quickly, is the emptiness. Is the final view, is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no composition factors, no consciousness, and so forth. So that's all very clear, all very powerful. And then the ornament, Maitreya takes it upon himself at the request of a Sangha to deliver
the stages, you know, the paths, the kind of you know, the sort of progress that you make all the way to enlightenment, and unfolding incredible detail all those different meditations and kind of, you know, realizations and kind of determinations that you have to proceed through, follow that long path. So we're on the application for complete aspects. Application, that's okay to say training, you know, that's a fine word to use. Our particular handbook likes to use the word application, but that's okay. But just don't think it's any more than just training or practice. The first three chapters go over the three great knowers that constitute, that the perfection of wisdom can be divided into. Knower of all aspects of the Buddha, knower of paths of the Bodhisattvas, knower of bases of those just seeking their own complete freedom in personal nirvana. And then, having studied those points and reflected upon them and understood them, then at the time of the training in complete aspects, then you have to start to, you know, study them in a combined manner. He said collectively yesterday, I think combined manner is best. You know, you study them one after the other in sort of series, sequences, so that you become, you know, get sort of, you know, completely at ease with them, gain mastery over them. So that's the idea of the application in complete aspects. So you're familiarizing with something you've already studied, you've already realized, but now you're just trying to pick up speed and get going with them. So that's what the Bodhisattvas, who are the, you know, the official, you know, beings, the sharp bodhisattvas, sharp-minded bodhisattvas, or the official trainees of the Order for Clear Realizations are supposed to be doing anyway. So whether we can quite do it at this stage, I don't know. All we do is just kind of just get mind-boggled by how many different bits and pieces there are. So anyway, that's how it is. So let's just learn what we can, become proficient. And, you know, that's a great imprint. Well, what did we touch on yesterday? We touched on, particularly on the solitary realizer path. So this is a branch of the hearer path, solitary realizer path. So these are the hearers who are spend a longer time on the path. Somehow they're needed. Somehow they sort of abide in solitude. Even when the teachings have sort of been lost elsewhere, they kind of keep the continuum going. But still, they're just going for their own personal nirvana. But in this school, they have their own particular, you know, emptiness to meditate on. It's not saying that they're the only ones who meditate on this. No, but this absence of apprehender and apprehended being different substantial entity, or absence of, you know, external reality. So these are kind of, this is the emptiness that associated with the mind-only school. But in this particular way of practicing of the Yogacara autonomy Majjhimikas, that's the job of the solitary realizers to meditate on that. But of course, you know, the Bodhisattvas have to know it. And the Buddhas also have got that knowledge in their continuum. So it's not only the Bodhisattvas, the solitary realizers who are meditating on it, you know. So in this school, you know, the mind-only view is as far as external reality goes, it's quite correct, you see. So it's a realization that Bodhisattvas and Buddhas must have. Bodhisattvas have it in order to be able to teach those hearers. You know? And Buddhas know everything, of course. Yes, so that's an interesting view, intriguing. I've never really sort of meditated on it a lot myself, but there's plenty to sort of ponder about there. So I don't know if you thought about it anymore, but what do you think then, while we all went away at night, closed up shop, switched off all the lights here, so did your table stay there while there was nobody here? All the bugs were asleep, you know, all the bugs had gone under the floorboards to do their thing. Nobody's looking at your table. No birds looking in through the window. So did your table stay there, Jane, while nobody was looking at it? If it's a mere appearance to mind, there are no minds looking at it. Well, we're talking about the table in front of you now, your table. We saw it yesterday. Anybody who bothered to look that in direction, you must have seen it. You know, we never noticed it, but you were looking at it. And then here it is today. Yeah, so, I mean, when I said, Jane, hey, Jane, you really perked up, he's talking to me, yeah? Mm-hmm. So I wasn't talking to the Jane of yesterday. I'm talking to the Janes here now. Yeah, so it's a continuity, yeah? We're all evolving, that's good to remember. But while we're evolving, we can still call ourselves by the same name, can't we? I called you Jane yesterday, you say, oh yes, hello. And if I said hello Jane today, you say, hello, it's me, yes. Yeah, but you've changed completely. All your atoms, billions of cells have disintegrated and another cells have come into your body. Yeah, complete change of your mental and physical aggregates. But still deserving to be called the name Jane. Same with your table. So is it... what happened to it? Was there a gap in its existence? When we all switched off the lights, close of business yesterday, and when Mike came in here about 5 a.m, started doing his prostrations and his offerings. So in between that time. So there was a gap in its existence then. You've just been copying that from Bishop Barclay. He says, oh, God sees it all. Can't just take all these Christian ideas and bring them over wholesale into Buddhism, you know. Is it? Don't remember that. What does it say? It's Buddha sees it, yeah. But who decides whether Buddha sees it? You know, Buddha only sees existence, right? He doesn't see non-existence. So it wasn't. So if it did go out of existence when nobody's looking at it, he wouldn't see it, would he? He would see the gap. Yeah, but. Buddha's one of the, that table is one of these contaminated, what do you call it, samsaric objects. You know, Buddha from his own side has got no need to see the table. Buddha from his own side just abides in non-dual awareness of his own emptiness or something. So he's not going to, from his own side, he isn't going to say, oh, I've got to keep looking at that table to make sure it stays in existence. Yes, you're introducing another factor there, like other sentient beings. That's another question. So that has to be treated differently, I think, yeah. But in terms of other objects, you know, the Buddha's got no need to see this table. Of course he might have emanated it. It might be, you know, made of just a Buddha substance or something. You know, it might be some very special table. But an ordinary one. You know, if we've no need to see it, well, Buddha's no need to see it. So if it drops out of our existence, he'll drop out of his existence because... He's just only looking at it, because only knowing it, because you know, we're knowing it, because it's just a sort of contaminated samsaric object. From his own side, he never sees those things. Just sees them because we're looking at them. So that handy one about, oh, well, you know, God's looking at it in the gaps. Not sure how it works for the Buddhist. Anyway. But that's the problem with this view, you know. That's one problem, which you bring to people's attention if you're trying to talk about mind-only view. What happens to things when nobody's looking at them? And the other one is sentient beings. Are they sentient beings? So Bishop Berkeley also had to deal with the problem. So he's saying, you know, of course he doesn't want to admit that he's the only person in the universe. So he's trying to prove that other beings exist too. So how you do that? That's another question. Yeah. So they may not have to have externally existing sort of form bodies. That can be some sort of appearance to your karma, I don't know. But the very fact of other sentient beings being there and you're interacting with other minds, it can't be just you and God after all, you know. There must be other beings too. So that's another question, how you get around that, you know. You can deny the existence of external phenomena, but other beings, other minds have got to be kind of external to your minds. So you get rid of external matter, you can say there's no external objects behind the appearances to our sense consciousnesses. But no, I don't think these mind-only people want to deny the existence of other beings. And Dharmakirti, he wrote a special text exactly on that subject. So that's about how you prove the existence of other beings by inference. Yeah. So he's basically saying, just as those people who believe in an external reality, how do they decide that there are other beings around? They're not just alone in this world. So you can just use the same argument, even though you are trying to deny an external sort of, you know, physical world, still you can use the same reasoning to decide that there are other beings that you're interacting with. And they're not just an appearance to your mind, but they actually have their own kind of, you know, history and karma and everything. Yeah, so that's just another thing you have to bear in mind to get kind of full picture of the mind-only view. You have to deal with establishing the existence of other people, other beings. Yeah. Okay, well, we'll leave that there because we have to move on, but interesting discussions on that view still to come. Okay, now, we better move on, though, because we've got, you know, so many different aspects to at least just glance at. So, we've probably done enough. Well, we have got to the end of the list of the 27 aspects of the Nara bases. So then, just have a quick look at, a token look at some aspects of the Nara paths. So that's in the next grouping. All right, don't worry. Yeah. Yeah, when they're directly realizing the Four Noble Truths on the path of seeing for the first time, yeah. Yeah. Yes, those are their paths of meditation, yeah.
But then there's six aspects of the truth paths that are seeing, but I'm not seeing.
Yeah, so again, that's still the hearer, still the solitary realizers. So the 11 are all to do with solitary realizers. I didn't go through them because, you know, there doesn't seem to be much going on there.
It's just because we're going to and
Mm.
Yeah. Yes, that's it's they're just jumping about, you know,
yeah.
And they don't really. It's only the commentators who decide, decipher all these things, you know. The Perfection of Wisdom Sutras won't be particularly informative, and then the ornament's very condensed, so the ornament's got just the very briefest mention, and then, yeah, so then the commentators have to sort of identify what all those words in the sutra are referring to. And, you know, they're pretty, it's not one steady lamrim type progression from, the beginner to the expert right at the other end of the book. It's, you know, they're jumping all over the place. So the path of seeing gets mentioned many times in different chapters, different topics, then different levels of the path of seeing. So here you go from the path of seeing, hearers, to the path of meditation, solitary realizers, and then you go back to the path of seeing, solitary realizers, then you're jumping from uncontaminated path to contaminated path. So that's just par for the course, I'm afraid. But in between, if you just keep your head on and don't sort of get panicky about that and all kind of freaked out or totally bored, you know, you piece together the situation. Do you know the difference between contaminated path and uncontaminated path? Something we can perhaps talk about more next time we meet. Just details of the path structure. An uncontaminated path is when you are actually absorbed in your realization of emptiness. So the Bodhisattva's realizing his meditation on the complete lack of true existence, yeah? So that's when he's on his path of seeing. And at that time, you know, this is looking from the perspective of a Bodhisattva who is, doing these meditations of the hearer path and the solitary realizer path. So in the meditative equipoise, when you're realizing emptiness for the first time here in the path of seeing, you are just, you have a non-dual awareness of your emptiness for the first time. Okay, so that's uncontaminated path because it's uncontaminated by appearances of true existence. So it's just you're seeing reality, yeah? You're seeing the first time ever something just as it is, you know, that sheer absence of those obscurations or those, you know, kind of appearances of things being truly existent when they're not. So that's only happens when you have the non-conceptual realization, yeah? Your original conceptual sort of realization of true existence by means of an inference. You realize emptiness, you realize true existence, but still it's not appearing in the way it actually exists. It's still appearing somehow, as if the emptiness itself is truly existence or something, they say. So there are still appearances of true existence, even though you're getting your main object, which is the emptiness of the Four Noble Truths or whatever. So because it's a conceptual realization, there are still kind of, some sort of a obscuring appearances to seeing it just as it is. But when you get onto the path of seeing it directly, with your yogic direct perceiver, then there's no more appearances of subjects and object, no more appearances of true existence. So you're seeing reality for the first time. So that's uncontaminated. But when you arise from your meditative equipoise in the sort of subsequent stage of the path of seeing, you can be reflecting on these things, but with a conceptual mind again, or meditating on other things like compassion, of course. But those are meditations where conventional truth is arising and so forth, or you're using the sort of mental images that you use with the thought consciousness. So anytime you're doing that, then the appearances of true existence have come back again. You know, like that's the sort of frequent remark, isn't it? That even though you realize emptiness, even though you realize directly when you arise from your meditation, and just looking at ordinary phenomena, then they still appear to be truly existent. You're not carried away by the existence, by that appearance. You know, you don't start developing your afflictive emotions because you know that things don't exist as they appear. You know that. But that'll be the contaminated path. You see, when you are meditating on things like compassion or whatever, after your direct realization of emptiness. So that's contaminated by what? By appearances of true existence. So we'll sort of repeat that next time. So now we have aspects of narrow paths. So again, this is on page 54 of the handbook. So the application and complete aspects. There's 170 of the aspects. So the first 27 are just those aspects of Nara bases, and the next 36 are aspects of Nara paths. As it happens, they're all to do with the Four Noble Truths again. So it's the same topics, but other ways of looking at them or something, other ways of other things to say about them. So I'm just going to quickly look at the five aspects of true sufferings, just to bring out just one point relevant to, the Bodhisattva's specific way of doing things. So that's on page 57. So amongst the 36 aspects of knower of paths, as we have here, then there are five aspects of true sufferings. So if you'd like to find that, bottom of page 57. So, as we've mentioned before, you see, normally if you were just thinking about the Four Noble Truths, ask how many aspects they've got, you have 16, four for each truth. That's how it'll come in, Lamrim textbooks. But you get in the Ornum for Clear Realizations, you get extra bits, like we've just seen. With an extra 11 paths for the solitary realizers. Here you have an extra one path. Instead of just five, you get six. So the first five are the first, sorry, instead of four, you get five. So the first four are just what you kind of usually expect. So at the bottom of page 57, these five aspects are shown by means of specific and general characteristics. So I think that means it's four specific and one general. Anyway, the specific ones are the ones we're used to. 16, impermanent, because they disintegrate from the point of view of continuity and from the point of view of an instant of time. So I think that means, as usual, impermanent. So all true sufferings and, all contaminated, compounded phenomena, whether they're true sufferings or not, actually are impermanent. But it's important to think of the samsaric objects, true sufferings, to be impermanent, because then you'll understand why they're considered to be suffering a bit better. Impermanent leads to suffering. So they disintegrate from the point of view of continuity. So I think maybe you should say continuum there. So I think that meant to be gross impermanence. Yeah? So after after so much time, one of these tables here, it'll get broken or something, and people throw it away. It'll just get smashed up or burnt or something. And eventually it'll get destroyed. Just as we, sooner or later, the end of our continuum will arrive. Doesn't mean that we'll completely go into nothing. We'll go to our next life, and our body will go back to the earth, or body will go up in smoke. So it's not like this, just the things continue to evolve, but no longer is there anything to which, the name table would apply, or the name Jane could be attached. Once a body and a mind come apart, there's nothing you can call Jane anymore. So it's that's the end of the continuum, gross impermanence. And then impermanent from the point of view of an instant of time, so each moment the object goes out of existence. So that's subtle impermanence. There's never a time when the thing isn't changing. So whatever you look at, when you look at it again, even a very tiny moment later, it will have changed. Whether you can see it or not is a different matter, but it will have changed. No matter how short you make that moment, from the beginning to the end of the moment, will have been some transformation. And then number 17, suffering. So that's on top of page 58. Suffering because they're objects to be discarded and do not accord with the Aryas. Yeah, suffering. So that not accord with the Aryas. And maybe that means does not accord with the Aryas' way of seeing things. Aryas are the superior beings. They're the one who've realized emptiness directly. They've seen reality. So anything that looks dodgy to them is called suffering. Yeah, it may look wonderful to us to have, you know, a healthy body and, you know, be young again and to be running around sort of full of, you know, the exuberance of youth. We might think that's a wonderful thing, you know. But if you're an Arya, a superior being, you see, oh, that's just somebody running around cycling existence, you know, sort of, you know, just frivolously kind of, you know, just having all the energy rather using it properly, you know. So something like, you know, being born in samsara to a superior being is like, you know, something they've renounced. It's something from their point of view that there are so much sort of greater states of happiness to aim for. To be satisfied with some samsaric kind of, you know, pleasure is completely, you know, deranged, because they've seen that, you know, that our possibilities are so much more, you know, transcendent, go completely beyond that, you know. If you realize a Buddha nature, how wonderful that would be. So to be stuck in samsara would be like another disaster. So it's like, it shows you how what the measure of suffering is, yeah? Does it cause the superior being's revulsion? That's how, you know, everything in samsara is getting called to be suffering. It's suffering from their perspective, because they can, you know, they really see how bad it is. From our perspective, you know, some things in samsara, you know, very wonderful, because we are just looking at it from a completely different point of view. So why is everything in samsara suffering? You know, because that from the Arya's point of view, it's just that, you know, for somebody who's reached that level, it's all kind of just so pathetic. So, you know, kind of, you know, clumsy and sort of so frustrating to be in samsara and be born again and again and so forth. Anyway, yeah, let's not take too long on this. Empty. Things are empty and selfless. Yeah, so maybe you're aware of the difference between empty and selfless at this point. I don't know. Do you think that empty there means empty of inherent existence? Yes, thank you. Yeah. So here, remember, we are not talking about from the, you know, we're talking about the aspects of the noble truths as they're realized by, you know, the people on the other paths of, you know, sort of hero paths. So what they realize is empty and selfless. So that's two aspects of realizing the kind of, you know, the lesser selflessness of somebody on an individual path. And so that is empty of a permanent, partless, what did you say, permanent, unitary, own-powered self, I'd say. But you said independent, did you? Yeah. Permanent, unitary, independent self. So that's, you know, the sort of core selflessness of persons. That's the selflessness of persons, of the person who's a different entity to the aggregates. There's no sort of controller self, you know, own-powered self controlling the aggregates, who's a different entity to the aggregates. So that's the one that's being refuted there. And then in the next one, selfless, that is that the aggregates themselves, or any one of the aggregates, isn't in the entity of this own-powered person. Yeah? So there's nothing within the aggregate that is an own-powered person, sort of the controller self, the self-sufficient, substantially existent self. I like to call it the controller self myself, you know. This is a selflessness that only refers to persons, doesn't refer to other phenomena. So it's got to be a selflessness which is, you know, something that a person can sort of mistakenly have. So this controller self, there's something coming out of the aggregates which controls the self in an own-powered way. So it controls the aggregates, but the aggregates don't control it. You see how that's something that could do, you know, you can dream of for a person, but you wouldn't say that you look at the parts of a table and say have a mistaken idea that there's an own-powered table controlling the parts and telling them what to do. You see, so it's not a selflessness, a grasping at a self which applies to phenomena directly like that. Anyway, so that's the four conventional aspects of the truth of suffering. But then, so the one you've got on top of that is number 20, entityness. That is an aspect lacking characteristics. Just that means, you know, what you're realizing in addition to those other four is that what you're looking at is empty of truly existing. It doesn't have any true existence. It doesn't have any ultimate existence. So this is a general characteristic that applies to, you know, to all the different all the different truths, not just not just specific to one of them. So the fifth aspect is a general characteristic because its reason is pervasive. It characterizes all phenomena, all compounded and uncompounded phenomena, as well as all contaminated and uncontaminated phenomena are empty of true existence. Yeah, so this is a very general kind of a realization. That's how it's seeing it anyway. So you can see how somebody on the individual path, or the path to individual liberation, the path to their own nirvana, so there's somebody who's meditating on the Nara basis as a hearer, with the hearer mentality, which is, you know, renunciation, they want to get out of psychic existence, but they haven't got this sort of, you know, supreme idea of travelling on the bodhisattva path. So all they need to realise is the selflessness that's contained within those, you know, those two, empty and selfless. So when they realise the characteristics of two sufferings, they're meditating on this sort of personal selflessness, absence of self-sufficient, substantially existent self, which is, you know, the controller self. So that's all they need to do, according to this Yogacara autonomy, Svatantrika, Yogacara autonomy, Majjhimaka kind of a presentation of the path. So that's fine for them. But you can see when the Bodhisattva comes along, when the Bodhisattva says, oh, no, I've got to meditate on the Nara basis in order to be able to teach these hearer types, you know, when they become my disciples. Yes, he's also got to know the Nara. He's also got to be expert in the Nara basis, but he's got a little bit more. He or she has got a bit more to add. So whenever the Bodhisattva's meditating, it's always got to be, you know, charged up with Bodhisattva, you know, with the Bodhisattva motivation. It's always got to be, you know, kind of accompanied by great compassion, bodhicitta. And on top of that, it should also have an understanding that everything is meditating on is lacking in true existence. So instead of a person sitting there saying there's a real person here and they're experiencing real suffering, or there's a real person here and I am, you know, I'm not sort of controlled by a controller self who's either a different substance from me or, you know, the same substance as my aggregates. There's no controller, self-sufficient, substantially existent self. There's just the aggregates or something, but still clinging to the aggregates as being real, you see, still clinging to the aggregates as truly existing. So that's how the Nara, you know, the hearer does it. with his motivation of renunciation and so forth, but not so much compassion, no understanding of true existence. But when the Bodhisattva meditates on the Nara basis, he meditates on the Nara basis with this bodhicitta in place and with this knowledge of the absence of true existence. So there's no real person there at all, and there's no real suffering there at all, sort of thing. So he has to have a kind of, you know, still the Nara basis, but it's, you know, what they call a Nara basis that's close to the effect of mother, and not a Nara basis that's distant from the effect of mother. So it's just useful to look at these five characteristics of the truth of past in the Bodhisattva kind of layout, just to make that point. Yeah? So one of these Nara bases is close to the effect of mother. One of these Nara bases is distant from the effect of mother. So that's terminology coming from the third chapter on the Nara bases. So, but I'm just bringing it in here just to make sure. The Bodhisattva has got skillly means. The Bodhisattva, that means he's using compassion. He or she is using compassion. Bodhicitta, bringing that to the table, not just the simple renunciation of the hearer, but he's also, of course, he's got the renunciation, that sort of turning away revulsion from samsara, but he's interested in bringing all sentient beings to some kind of level of complete happiness too. And along with skillful means, he's got an understanding that everything has a lack of characteristics. Everything has a lack of, true characteristics. You sort of got to see everything that you're meditating on as empty as well, you see. So that's how that meditation becomes much more powerful. That's how it becomes a meditation which takes them close to the knower of all aspects. So I think it's close to the effect of mother. It's getting closer to the final goal, whereas the... the Nara basis, with their sort of correct meditation on the Nara, as a Nara basis, they have the correct antidote to their afflictions, but it only goes so far, you see, it only goes to individual nirvana. So just to... make that clear... So this is a verse from the third chapter, right? Not the fourth chapter, but it just underscores, or just sort of, it gives you some, you know, the ornament type of vocabulary in discussing and getting this point across. Through lack of means, she is distant. Because characteristics are observed, through skill in means, her proper closeness is proclaimed. So that's the verse. So how do you understand that? Oh, that looks all very difficult. But it's just saying, you know, through being without means, without this skillful compassion means, and lacking prajna, lacking the full wisdom of the Bodhisattva, one falls into being a shravaka, which is a hearer. You may wonder, is there a difference between the two kinds of knowledge of basis? So that's the hearer's knowledge of basis and the Bodhisattva's knowledge of basis. There is a difference for the following reasons. Through lack of means, so lack of vast merit, and because of characteristics, because characteristics with regard to their own enlightenment are observed, so that means, you know, they're looking on things as truly existent, so looking at things having truly existent characteristics, so here it says looking with regard to their own enlightenment, they're observing it to be truly existent, therefore a knowledge of bases of hearers and solitary realizers is distant from the effect of mother. But the one of noble beings, the one of the Nara basis of the noble bodhisattvas, is proclaimed as a proper closeness to the fruitional mother, which does not observe any characteristics with regard to enlightenment, and is skilled in means. The sutras say, if any sons or daughters of good family entertain any notions by focusing on the mother, they will drive this mother off. It is wonderful to see the extent to which this mother of bodhisattvas has been taught well and rounded off well. Okay, so that's just something from the, you know, the aspects of the Nara path. Just picked out a little topic there. So then, next one is aspects of Nauravola, aspects of the Nauravola aspects. But any question you have there? Did you get what I'm saying?
Just one is why the order is different here in this case, because it doesn't start with the two suffering, but the two origins in case of aspects of Nauravola. Is there a reason for that?
Yes.
One is two origins, and then true paths, and then comes the true sufferings, the end of 16.
And true cessations.
Yeah.
Yes.
True cessations.
Well, it's a different grouping, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you have the two causes. You have the cause of the bad things, which is true origins. Then you have the cause of the good things, which is true paths. So then you have the effect of the bad things, which is true sufferings. And you have the effect of the good things, or the result of the good things, which is true cessation. Yeah. So it is a different order. It's not the usual order that it's put forward, that it's presented in. But on the page, at the bottom of page 54 of the handbook itself, there is a reason given. I mean, it may be not a very kind of, you know, sort of illuminating or, you know, reason with a lot of kind of, you know, nutrition in it, but it says the Four Noble Truths in this context of the aspects of Nara paths are set out in the order of causes and results, the two causes first and the two causes second, which is an unusual order. I accept that. This is for the special purpose of making known one, the forward order of entering into cyclic existence, independent upon the thoroughly afflicted, true origins being the cause and true sufferings being the result. So it's a sequence that makes sense in one way, you know. First you give the cause of why you get into cyclic existence, and then you give the description of what happens in cyclic existence, origins and then causes. And also for making known the reverse order of exiting from cyclic existence, it depends upon the completely pure. So your way of getting out, first of all, they teach you the cause of getting out through paths, and then they teach you, you know, what it's like to be out. Once you're out of cyclic existence, then you're in a state of true cessation. So it's a different order. You can find a rationale for it.
Yes,
thank you. Maybe that's an unusual order, so they have to make some kind of devise some sort of explanation for that. Thank you. Good. So it's time for a cup of tea.
We're a bit late, are we?
Am I right on my timing? Had a long session there. Yeah, a bit late. But not too late. So let's have a break then. Cup of tea. 20 minutes.